You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggle for love and revolution. This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we speak with Chuck Collins of Inequality.org and the Institute for Policy Studies about his new book, Born on Third Base, a one percenter makes the case for tackling inequality, bringing wealth home, and committing to the common good.
In a society with extreme inequality and insecurity and poverty, there's only a couple ways you can respond. One is to sort of numb out. The other is to create a powerful story that justifies those inequalities. But if you remain open-hearted and you're tuned in, then you feel something. You feel a wound, a suffering. You feel the pain of an unequal and unfair society.
Hello and welcome to all of our listeners. I'm your host, Rivera Sun, and you are tuned into Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart. It is a sunny day here in Taos, New Mexico, and in case you hadn't guessed by the fact that I'm doing the introduction, we are flying solo today on the show. Sherry unfortunately couldn't be with us for this interview, but don't worry, folks, we'll have her back on next week. This week, we are going to talk about one of those great big issues that underlies all aspects of our lives, has shaped and formed many of our available choices and opportunity in our lives, and is never given the right kind of attention by the powers that be or by the media in general. You'll recognize our guest. It's Chuck Collins. We had him on the show about 6 months ago, along with Daryl Garner, to talk about inequality from the vantage point of being a former member of the 1%. Now, Chuck Collins was one of the heirs to the Oscar Mayer meatpacking fortune, but he gave it up when he was 26. But he has spent his life working on the issues of inequality and conversely creating greater economic equality throughout the United States and the world. And he has also written a bunch of books, including 99-1, Wealth in Our Commonwealth, and a new book that we'll talk about today, Born on Third Base. Now, the last thing you should know about Chuck, because we're going to talk about this in the show, is that he's a researcher, campaigner, storyteller, and writer for the Institute for Policy Studies. We're going to ask him about policy in the era of this new administration. So that was some hints for you, Chuck, about questions coming up in the show. But first of all, welcome.
Great to be with you.
Chuck, I want to start with talking about this new book, Born on Third Base. A one percenter makes the case for tackling inequality, bringing wealth home, and committing to the common good. Now, you said basically two phrases in there that I often think of the 1% as being allergic to: bringing wealth home to a greater community, and the common good. Will you speak a little bit about your motivation behind writing this book and the themes that are explored in general in the book?
One motivation is I think we're in an unusual moment, which is these extreme inequalities of wealth and power are compounding and accelerating. But I don't actually think it's a good trend for anybody. I mean, I think people think, oh, this is good. The economy's benefiting the rich. You know, the rich must be happy. But I actually been sort of engaging with people who have wealth and saying, look, this is actually getting too concentrated, too top heavy. And it's going to undermine everything you care about. And it's certainly going to create a kind of apartheid society for subsequent generations. So I'm kind of, one reason I wrote this book was to engage people who have wealth, not just the 1%, but, you know, the top 10%, and say these inequality trends are not where anyone wants to go. And so come on back and engage, and let's all hands on deck, let's try to fix things.
Now, do the 1%ers or the 10%ers agree with you? Do they also see that this inequality is creating instability, creating actually the kind of community, the kind of social structures that humanity has been working to equalize and unravel for hundreds of years now? Or are you encountering a lot of resistance to these ideas?
Well, I think it's all over. There's a segment of people, a small segment, that use their wealth and power to get more wealth and power, and they cloak that in a set of stories or justifications. And then there are people who totally see things as I see them and see that these trends are really bad, that they need to step up, and many of them kind of do step up behind the scenes and try to invest and give and pay their taxes with an eye toward creating a more equitable society. I would argue that probably the vast majority of people, say, in that wealth group, my born on third base cohort, are not that engaged. They're kind of like the rest of the society. They're not engaged. They're distracted, or they're involved in caretaking or whatever it is that people do. But that it's time to engage those folks and engage their wealth and power to fix the future. So that's where I think I see things all over the place, really.
That's interesting that you mentioned that the lack of engagement is one of our failings as a nation, that we have a number of issues, but in this context, we're talking about inequality and their economy, and that we have a small percentage of our populace actually engaged in changing that or working on changing that, both in the 1% and throughout the 100%. Where are some of the places of engagement that you are seeing people engage with? I'm thinking of like the New Economy Coalition. The transition movement, of course, has elements of this. Occupy was a major moment of engagement for 1 million people in this country, at least. Where are you seeing people engage and how?
Well, I think actually the number of people engaging is increasing by the day. You know, in part thanks to the new president. He seems to be getting a lot of people out of the woodwork. But I think it is. It's participating in things at the local level, as you mentioned, the transition movement that's kind of helping think about how do we prepare for changes in the economy and the ecology. I see people joining sort of online organizing groups, but using that as a way to get people together, you know, whether it's Our Revolution or Move On or some of the many others. So I think it's, I don't know the exact numbers, but you know, if you have 15% of the population engaged, you actually do have pretty high level of engagement. Because if you think about it, there are a lot of people caring for children and caring for elders, fully occupied and just trying to survive and make a living, grappling with illness or addiction. You know, that, there's a large segment of our society that understandably is having to pay attention to other things. So it's really a matter of how well we engage everyone else who has a sense of agency and time to participate in social movements and in politics.
Well, let's go to the title of your book, Born on Third Base, and the ancillary part of that, which is your story. Because Born on Third Base has been used for quite some time to refer to the unequal positions and privileges within our society, that some people are born on third base, other people are never even put up to bat. And so those who hit the those who reach home, so to speak, and it's kind of funny that you're giving out this call for the wealthy to come home, there's a disadvantage or an advantage to some versus others. Now, you yourself have described yourself as being born on third base. Will you speak a little bit about why that is and then what your choice was about changing that or challenging that paradigm?
Yeah, the original kind of saying was, this person thinks they were born, was born on third base, but thinks they hit a triple, meaning that they had this huge head start, but they still think that their success is mostly attributed to them. And that's the, in some ways, the narrative or the story that I think in part holds inequality in place. People don't identify or fess up to all the ways in which they get help. So for me, I grew up in a family that was safely in the top echelon of wealth in America in a wealthy, affluent suburb of Detroit. And it was pretty clear to me that I didn't do anything except choose the right parents. And of course, I had no role in that either. So I completely just showed up in an economic strata where most people spend their entire lives working to get to. So the myth that I somehow had some special quality, you know, obviously didn't take very well with me. I am surprised of other people who are born in similar circumstances to mine kind of remake their story into one of deservedness and hard work. And I think that takes a huge leap. But nonetheless, people do it every day.
The myth of deservedness or the story of deservedness is very strong in the U.S. It goes along with our colonialism and our pioneer mentality and the mythology that surrounds the rugged individual. And it has an earlier predecessor to my mind, and that is the divine right to rule, or the idea that God chose some people to be wealthy and powerful for whatever reason God might have. Today we have this myth of deservedness. We've secularized it, but it actually functions in our society in the same way, proposing that those who are wealthy deserve to be wealthy, and those who are poor, conversely, deserve to be poor. But anyone who's taken a real close look at the structural inequalities in our world knows that that's unfounded in many ways. It can't be demonstrated to have any real validity. I mean, when we look at sexism, racism, historic injustices that pile up over generations, and wealth is an arena in which we can actually document that very well. In your book, you talk a little bit about the white affirmative action, or the magic carpet to the middle class that was created in programs such as the GI Bill or housing bills that helped largely the white population start to actually form a wealth base after the Great Depression. Will you speak a little bit about those programs and how they play into the myth of deservedness that persists in our country?
Yeah, I think that's a really good observation. I mean, we tend to associate wealth with virtue. I think its effect is to soften people's outrage about levels of inequality, because people say, oh, those people are wealthy because they work harder and have made a big contribution to society, and we all value that, and isn't that great? But I think that the mythology of deservedness sort of plays out not just among the very wealthy, but you know, even if you have any advantage, I think people forget or mystify the advantages or help that they've gotten. And an example of that is after World War II, 1945 to the mid-70s really, we as a society taxed wealthy people and invested in things that brought in the middle class, like first-time homebuyer programs, debt-free college education, public infrastructure investments that created good jobs. A lot of those wealth-building initiatives were racially discriminatory. The mortgage programs were almost by design exclusive. They left brown and black people and First Nations people out of the wealth-building train. The debt-free education opportunities largely went to white returning GIs, black GIs going back to Jim Crow South, didn't get to take advantage of those public goods and opportunities. So we kind of put millions of white folks on the wealth-building express train, and we left blacks and Latinos and First Nations people just sort of standing at the station waiting for the train that never showed up. And many people who got those post-World War II benefits sort of forget about them. They don't tell their children, oh, we were the beneficiaries of these government subsidies, and that's what makes it possible for me to help you buy a house or have access to education. It enters into the sort of American mythology of it's all about individual effort. So that's an example to me of how the stories of deservedness not only play out among the wealthy, but among many, many people.
Well, I think in the story of deservedness, there is a sincere and genuine wish for people to actually deserve what they have achieved. And we don't want to devalue that. That I think sometimes when people are saying these stories, when we explain the myths around deservedness, people often get very defensive because they want to believe that they have done it through hard work and through being strong and persevering. And they often are equally resentful that someone is saying, no, actually, you didn't necessarily. And to me, there's something very precious about human nature in that phenomenon. But there is another approach that you articulate in your talks and your lectures, which is about the capacity to tell true stories, to actually identify what has helped us, be honest about it, be articulate about it, and then also be able to critique the limits of those programs or advantages toward the end of making them helpful and available to all people. Will you speak a little bit about the role of telling true stories? It's a concept that refrains in your work, and it's a invitation that you often make to people of all backgrounds, but especially the wealthy.
Well, I think that the first thing to say is that individuals do matter, individual effort. There are people who make extraordinary sacrifices, whether they're teachers and don't get financial rewards, or in some cases, entrepreneurs who start something. And, you know, so I think the point is not to minimize that or ignore it, but to lift it up and celebrate it. It is part of the story. Where I think we, as a society, certainly are weak is seeing the role of the Commonwealth or all the public investments and institutions, all the things we do together that create a healthy, fertile ground for wealth creation. So I find it powerful to, you know, engage with people who are kind of aware of both their individual effort and public and societal investments and tell their stories through the lens of, you know, how did I get help? How did my family help me? What subsidies or opportunities did I take advantage of that other taxpayers paid for? What was that foundation for me? So I think that we need to change the policies and the rules, but we also have to change the stories that sort of hold these inequalities in place.
One of the things that comes to mind is the role of the Commonwealth, that historically we've seen a major shift. We had David Bollier, the Commons researcher and scholar, who spoke about the enclosures of the Commons historically and how we are in another wave of enclosure of what remains of our Commonwealth. And we're seeing this very markedly around two arenas, one being water and another being the privatization of public assets, which has been a growing problem in the United States, but is about to escalate with what horror story author Stephen King called the motley crew of plunder monkeys who are coming into cabinet positions right now. That we're about to see a great pillaging of the Commonwealth that remains in the United States. Would you care to speak more about the role of the Commonwealth in the work that you do, the call for the wealthy to come home and invest in the Commonwealth, and some of the current trends that are going on around the remnants of Commonwealth, and perhaps the dynamic of shrinking or expanding our Commonwealth?
Well, I think you described it well, which is we exist thanks to a sort of web of Commonwealth around us, whether it's the ecological commons of water and oxygen and soil and that which gives us life. But there's this social commons. There's the things that we build together, the internet, language, public investments and infrastructure. No one privately owns them and no one individually can claim ownership of them. And yet a lot of wealth is extracted from the commons by people and corporations and others who basically are saying, let's take from the commons, but not give back. And the story of individual wealth creation in the United States is often the story of, you know, an individual's effort combined with tapping into the commons, whether it's extracting natural resources or whatever. So I think that's the challenge that we're currently facing. And part of the work in this moment is to protect that which is the commons, both to name it, identify it, and protect it, and maybe give it legal status even. You know, maybe the oxygen or the or the airwaves upon which we have this conversation and broadcast is a public trust and should be owned and managed as a public trust.
Chuck, one of the things that I feel is on the rise with the new administration and the Republicans coming to power, but also not just with them, but with certain strands of neoliberalism, is the unraveling or the resentment of any constraints that might be placed upon an individual or an individual's company's ability to access resources and profits. And it's often framed in this very Ayn Randian sort of, you know, give me my liberties and freedom to be my highest potential in terms of individuals, entrepreneurship, businesses. You know, we have seen numerous documentaries coming out about different tech industry giants kind of glorifying these aspects of these characters. And it stands in contrast to the Commonwealth and to the idea that, as my co-host often says, along with rights come responsibilities, that we don't just exist as individuals in infinite universe that has infinite resources. We exist as individuals interconnected with other beings, including the ecological limits that we're facing. How do people address this conundrum of wanting freedom, but also needing to take responsibility? And the frame that I think might be interesting to explore in the context of this conversation is around the perceptions of the wealthy. Like, what do they do with their wealth? How do they build their wealth? What are the restraints and limits or responsibilities that come along with massive fortune or massive wealth accumulation?
Yeah, I think we have a very kind of narrow notion of freedom where we don't see ourselves in a society or in a web or part of something bigger. So people get this idea like, oh, freedom is my ability to plunder or freedom to take all the water out of the ground. And as you say, you know, if once we understand that we live on a finite planet, and that there are limits to what we, the wealth that we hold and can manage together, then freedom is not just about individual being able to do whatever they want. It's in the context of the common good. It must be balanced with a community interest. And again, coming back to sort of the image of water, we are all downstream. So if imagine we're living on a circular river, you know, I can't just take what I want and I just can't dump what I want. Now, some people associate that with freedom, but it is actually the responsibility of living in an interconnected society. I see this all the time, though. I think one of the rationales is it's my money. I can do what I want with it, you know, which, again, ignores the sources of the money, the way in which society and essentially co-creates some of that wealth and value. You hear this in philanthropy. I can give the money, you know, I can create a foundation. And I don't have to pay taxes. I'll create a foundation and I'll give to what I want, you know, and I'll buy portraits of myself, put them up on walls. That's a acceptable charitable purpose. What we don't always understand or say is, well, actually, society chips in 40 to 50 cents of every dollar that a billionaire gives to charity. By losing tax revenue, the rest of us have to pick up the slack. And so we as a society have a public interest in what an individual does with their money. And that's just another example that that's why we have laws that govern charities and you can't just do whatever you want. So some people feel like that's a, you know, like wearing a dog collar and getting their dog leash pulled. But that is what it means to live in an interconnected society. You just don't get to do whatever you want with whatever's there.
Well, let's dive into charities and the charitable industrial complex, because this is something that you talk about in your book, Born on Third Base, and I find it quite bold of you. Now, I have heard people involved in social justice movements critiquing the big nonprofits and the charitable industrial complex. We had our guest from the U.S. Department of Arts and Culture, Adam Horowitz, commenting about the SOBs, the symphonies, operas, and ballets, and the imbalance of the funding around them in proportion to cultural democracy, that when we overfund these very westernized, elitist forms of art and culture, we actually basically underfund everything else that we might otherwise be supporting. Now, when Rockefeller first applied to create the Rockefeller Foundation to Congress in his day, there was a process he had to go through, they turned him down because of the fear that big philanthropy would have the same negative impact on society that was being seen in big money and big trusts at the time. As we know, he didn't get turned down forever. And we do have big money and big philanthropy and this same imbalance of inequality and the creation of the world that the wealthy want to see through the vehicles that they own and operate, be that philanthropies, foundations, businesses, donations to politicians. It's actually a cross-sector of a problem. But if you would care to say more about the problem of big philanthropy and the concentration of wealth, I think that would be highly informative.
Yeah, and I think the first thing to say is that we live in a society that is sustained by gifts, gift economy, sharing, people helping each other, mentoring each other. Alongside that, we have created this whole sort of tax structure and set of organizations that have a set of rules, you know, the independent nonprofit sector, charitable foundations, where someone can give to charity and reduce their taxes on the theory that what they're giving to will relieve the burdens of government and serve a public good. So here we are today, you know, 2017, in a period of great inequality, we're seeing the emergence of these huge mega foundations. And really, over the next 20 years, it will only grow. Meanwhile, the sort of popular, you know, giving, donations by small and medium givers, which is very important, is steadily going down. So we are at this risk, and I think the original congressional concern there about John D. Rockefeller's foundation is, you know, will these foundations just become more extensions of private wealth and power? And that's the fear, and that's something we should be very, very concerned about.
Now, Chuck, you had a study that came out through the Institute of Policy Studies, I believe, about this very issue, and I did note that statistic about how big giving is up and small and mid-sized giving is down. Does that parallel a trend in just basic wealth of the populace, that we basically, people are giving to the extent of their capacity, but their capacity is going down? Because I remember it used to be that, you know, proportional to income and wealth, people on small budgets actually end up giving much more than people on large budgets proportionally. So I'm just curious if that trend, do you think it mirrors economic constraints that people are feeling?
Yeah, that's our theory. The study we did is called Gilded Giving, Top-Heavy Philanthropy in an Age of Inequality. And I think what's happening to low and middle income givers is economic insecurity is rising, wages are stagnant, people are just not able to give as much. They still do give in a sacrificial way and generously. So what you mentioned, lower income people give more. And especially if you don't include, you know, everything that gets measured. You know, nobody's saying people who give as coaches or mentors or volunteers. Many people don't take tax deductions for that. Those are the gifts that hold us together, that weave and hold communities together. And there's a tremendous generosity that exists below the surface of the, you know, dog-eat-dog predatory capitalism that we're living in. And my fear is how that predatory extractive capitalism sort of continues to just weaken the voluntary, generous gift economies that sustain us. But yeah, the trends are not good, and they absolutely mirror the trends of inequality. The concentration of wealth has led to the great concentration of new foundations.
And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID and your weekly dose of nonviolence. On this week's Nonviolence Minute, we're going to share with you the 10 aspects of Chuck Collins' bold invitation to bring the wealth home. In his book, Born on Third Base, he lays out the many reasons why the 1% should stop stockpiling wealth and instead reinvest it in projects and enterprises that build greater economic equality and community resilience. Number 1. Root yourself in a new story. The first step in the journey, he writes, is to root ourselves in a new story. The wealthy can choose to act from fear or in scarcity, or from gratitude, acknowledging the enormous gifts around us. One part of this practice is to open our eyes and hearts to see the web of people, nature, ancestors, and our community that has made the positive aspects of our lives possible. This means acknowledging that our wealth comes in part thanks to a commonwealth that includes the gifts of nature and society around us. The second part of the bold invitation to the 1% to bring their wealth home that Chuck Collins extends is to tell true stories about wealth. He says, "You are invited to help demystify the confusion about wealth, success, and privilege by telling true stories. There is no shame in acknowledging the reality that any wealth held in your name is the result of the ecological commons plus your efforts or someone else's hard work, combined with the fertile ground that previous generations and today's workers and taxpayers helped to build. Your own personal story of help will provide a powerful counter-narrative to the I-did-it-alone stories that currently dominate our culture." The third part of the bold invitation is to help redefine wealth and see the commonwealth. The 1% are invited to help redefine wealth and steer the culture away from a narrow definition of wealth as property, money, and financial capital. Real wealth includes a healthy ecological commons, a web of community institutions, and security based on authentic and caring relationships. This is the wealth that money cannot buy, but that is being degraded by predatory capitalism and narrowly defined financial wealth. The fourth part of the bold invitation is to put a personal stake in a place and work for the common good. Each day, Chuck writes, we cast votes for the kind of future we want. Coming home means voting with your feet and life commitment, bringing your time, treasure, and talents to a place. He encourages the wealthy to resist the urge to privatize one's needs through the creation of private recreational paradises, private education and transportation, or gated or enclave communities. Instead, he encourages them to develop a personal stake in quality public education, livable communities, and healthy ecosystems. He encourages them to make a commitment to ensure that the lives of all children are as good as the lives of the children in one's own extended family. The fifth part of the bold invitation is simply to bring the wealth home. The wealthy control trillions in capital, money that has been chasing speculative financial returns at the global level. It's time to bring this wealth home and redirect it into enterprises in the real economy. There is a range of options, including opportunities in the community investment and slow money movements that are investing in community financial institutions and high-impact investments. The sixth part of the invitation is to catalyze change around the ecological crisis. There are many aspects to this part of the invitation, including reducing one's carbon footprint, less jet-setting and being more geographically rooted, and reducing an overall energy consumption, not just shifting to green technologies. He also calls for the wealthy to divest from ecologically destructive enterprises and invest in ecologically supportive enterprises. Number 7 is to share the wealth. The invitation is to give away wealth deeply and boldly. In spite of some of the limits of charity, well-targeted social change funding is critical to transformation. The good news is that there is now a very experienced network of advisors, community foundations, resource books, and seasoned elders who can guide and support the wealthy in this journey. Number 8 is to pay your taxes. The most democratic means of redistributing wealth and power is through taxation, especially at the state and local levels. Just because we don't like every activity of the government or have concerns about government inefficiency does not justify withdrawing funds from the system or dodging taxes. Instead, Chuck Collins encourages the wealthy to use their voices to defend and expand the progressivity of the tax system at all levels, and to be engaged as an advocate for effective and efficient government. Number 9 is to support the leadership of others, especially working-class people. Chuck writes that we are surrounded by working-class people who are resourceful and have a lot to teach us. Our liberation is tied up with our ability to be humbled by these neighbors, seek them out, befriend them, support them, and follow them. He encourages the wealthy to participate with humility. Our role, he writes, is not to withdraw, nor is it to solely be a faucet of resources for others to deploy. You hold a piece of the puzzle in terms of what it means to be human. The role of the 1% is to be engaged without dominance or manipulation. The 10th point of his bold invitation is probably the most radical. Chuck Collins encourages people in the 1% to reach out and to organize their peers. He writes directly to the 1% in this section and says, "You are invited to reach out and engage others from our class background. Who else will organize them?" To this end, he encourages people to form small groups. He says, "None of us can figure this out alone. We know that to change and transform ourselves, we need inspiration, support, challenge, accountability, and respect. We need our siblings and cousins in the 99% to generously extend to us an invitation to the table, to break bread and sit together. We need to be invited home, welcomed at the door, and offered a role and place, not at the head of the table, but among the respected." While Chuck Collins' invitation is framed largely for the 1%, there are many aspects of what he has articulated that also apply to us throughout the 100%. There is much in his bold invitation to reflect upon and to put into motion in our own lives and decisions. If there is even just one thing that shifts in your world or your approach to our shared conversation about wealth, economy, and how we share our resources, then this Nonviolence Minute has indeed changed your life. And now let's turn to our program. Now, another trend that I'm curious to ask you specifically about is, you know we have extreme inequality in the U.S., and my question is, in the framework of extreme inequality, does concentrated wealth equal widespread poverty? Are they in direct relationship to one another, or is it possible to have a large middle class and concentrated wealth? I'm just curious because I've never gotten this question actually answered.
I think there is a relationship, but it doesn't inherently necessarily have to be that way. You could have a society that has extraordinary concentrated wealth that also has a sort of benevolent floor that makes a decision to invest in such a way that no one experiences homelessness or great deprivation. That's a theory. The reality is, the more wealth concentrates in fewer hands, the more there's kind of a breakdown in social solidarity, where the wealthy are really not in relationship and are disconnected from poverty, and therefore are not able to act in such a way that sees it in their interest to reduce poverty. And that's more the history. The more unequal a society is, the less there is a political will to address poverty. I mean, think about this, Rivera. In 1965, probably the period of greatest equality in U.S. history, we had a war on poverty. There was this sort of national effort to address poverty. And here we are at a period of our greatest level of inequality, and poverty is almost rendered invisible among the political class. There's no desire to even talk about it. So that's an example to me of the more unequal you are, the greater the breakdown in social solidarity and the greater poverty and exclusion of those at the bottom.
Well, that is really intriguing, and It mirrors some other theories that have been postulated on this program around empathy neurons and the ways that we relate to one another and the importance of humanizing the issues that we face as a collective society, whether we're on the side of the oppressor or the side of the oppressed. That one of the ways wars and violent conflicts breaks out is to dehumanize and to make it about statistics or, you know, evil people or the slur of the moment. And one of the ways in peace building to reduce the likelihood or the actuality of violent conflict is to actually humanize the equation so our empathy neurons kick in. We do have a very primal, actually, human response to resolve the conflict in a way that serves the greatest good of all the participants in the conflict. So that's an intriguing observation you just brought up. Now, you kept speaking about the social fabric. That wasn't the word you used, but I want to go back to that because one of the things we also don't measure in terms of wealth and giving in our society is the ways in which the poor pick up the broken fabric of the social safety net. Now, in the class war, we hear the wealthy end of the spectrum ranting and raving about the freebies and the giveaways and the Social Security and the Medicare and the health plans and all of that stuff. And the reality is that most of that is hot air and rhetoric, and that they're constantly undermining the very services that were put in place to resolve social inequalities and the inability of the populace to get access to the things that we need and to take care of each other. Now, in a time when we're eroding, or when our politicians are eroding those programs, the people who pick up that slack are the people in the networks generally and the social circles of poverty and the lower end of the spectrum. That if your sister doesn't have health care, you end up taking care of your sister. If you don't have money to put your mother in a nursing home, your mother comes to live with you. Things like that. So I want to connect this to something that you spoke about in your book, which is community resilience. You give a direct call to the 1% to come home, to bring their wealth, and to specifically invest in community resilience. Now, this includes things like what we think of as social services or social programs. It includes things like healthcare. It includes things like mentorship. And it includes things like economic and ecological resilience. Why is this so important to you? And why do you think that this is not only a crucial thing for the wealthy to invest in, but also a critical thing at this juncture of human history?
Well, I think just to build on what you said, I think our natural state is to be empathetic, to feel something when you hurt, or when I hurt, you feel something. And in a society with extreme inequality and insecurity and poverty, there's only a couple ways you can respond. One is to sort of numb out. The other is to create a powerful story that justifies those inequalities. But if you remain open-hearted and you're tuned in, then you feel something. You feel a wound, a suffering. You feel the pain of an unequal and unfair society. I write also that the privilege is a disconnection drug. It keeps people apart. It keeps people from feeling what it's like. And one of the things that I counsel is, you know, for wealthy people, coming home means being connected. It means coming back into the sort of authentic community. And as you say, Rivera, communities of survival, people who are trying to help each other, have a sort of deeper, authentic connection and community. And wealthy people have resources, but they often are disconnected. So I think part of the work of building community resilience is everybody comes home. Everybody kind of dives in and does everything we can to create equitable and healthy and ecologically sustainable space in our communities. And part of the is to say to people who are wealthy, don't miss this one. Bring your capital, bring your social networks, bring what you have to the table, along with people who have other resources and other kinds of resourcefulness and resilience, which many working class and low income communities also bring to the table. And I think that's how we're going to weather the economic and ecological changes ahead.
One of the questions that I have for you is, in your book, Born on Third Base, you tell true stories about wealthy people who have chosen to give up all or large parts of their wealth. And two of the stories that stood out to me were Jenny Ladd's story of divesting from fossil fuels at this critical time, and then also Deborah Freeze's story and injunction to walk away from Wall Street. Would you speak about these two choices of what to do with one's wealth and why they might be important to consider?
Well, part of it is to realize that we are between these two systems. And Wall Street, the model of investment there is about extraction. Fossil fuel sector is clearly about extracting, you know, carbon assets and burning them. That is their business model. And it's they're hell-bent on moving us toward uninhabitable living situation. So part of the role of wealth and capital is to divest, shift capital out of the sort of destructive systems and move it to, you know, the real economy, the healthy economy of goods and services and sustainable enterprises. Yeah, and so Jenny and Deborah are both great examples of that. Jenny saying, look, you know, I'm an heir to Standard Oil. Isn't that poetic? Our family wealth for a century has been built on the extraction of fossil fuels. Seemed like a good idea 100 years ago. Clearly, it's not a good idea now. So I'm going to use my capital and vote with my capital to put it in the new energy economy. And similarly with Deborah, taking money out of, she calls it going off the Wall Street grid and putting the capital into impact investing and community investing, moving the capital directly to the jobs and livelihoods and businesses of the future. So those are two great examples of really the moving the money and bringing capital home.
I thought it was interesting how you wrote about Deborah's view on usury, the making of money off of other people needing money, because it is such a historic issue. I mean, it's written about in the Bible. This is not a new thing. And for those who are wondering, the reference in the Bible is to not do it, that it's actually considered a terrible thing to do. And, you know, Wall Street is very much at this point based on that model, on making money off of other people's need to access capital and money. And it has created these cycles and these just crashes and booms and crashes and booms. And throughout the recent crashes and booms, the people who really have lost out are those who are poor, working class, middle class. And the ones who have really made fortunes, literally, by and large, although some have lost great fortunes, but by and large, this has created a huge upswing of wealth to the wealthy. One of the noted trends is that the rebound from the 2008 crash went largely to the 1%, and the rest of us really didn't see any recovery or rebound. And this really, every time we mention it, people go, oh yeah, I live that experience. I know that reality. So one of the questions that I have for you in all of this is about breaking these large systems, about changing these large systems. What might be a few tips that you have had from walking on both sides of this equation to people who are looking to maybe stop the class war and wage just peace for economic justice? What are some ways that people in general can approach this?
Well, I think that the concept of walking off the Wall Street grid, of essentially non-cooperating in terms of capital in those kinds of institutions that are focused on usury and extraction, that's a good example. So let's look at each way in which we as a consumer, as a saver or investor, as a worker, all sort of support the systems, this current extractive, hyper-extractive capitalism we're living in, and are there ways to delink and non-cooperate? And wealthy people who have disproportionate control over capital have some power here and can actually make a huge difference. And again, if you're taking your capital out of, you know, ExxonMobil, and you're putting it into a local worker-owned wealth management, waste management company, which is one of the examples in Born on Third Base, you're not going to get 20% return on your investment. because that's a usurious level of interest. That's not just lending money and covering your costs and risk of capital. That's taking someone else's labor and making them work for you effectively. And that was always the historic and religious prohibition on usury, was a recognition that interest above a certain level, and some people believe any interest, is essentially a taking. It's an extraction. And if you want to have a beloved community, if you want to have cohesion within the tribe and within the group, you don't charge interest to your neighbor. And that if you, you know, we've done the opposite. We've had generation after generation of my grandchildren owing your grandchildren, and the debts piling up. And that's where deep historic injustices come from.
So, Chuck, we're in a new era, people are saying. After the election, we really entered in a whole new time, whole new ballgame of politics in America. What are some of the dynamics you see around wealth, inequality, social justice movements, and the future of advancing equality and justice around our economy and our wealth and inequality here in the U.S. now that we are in this new era, this new administration, and this new presidency that is really not looking good for equality and justice in general?
Well, I actually see kind of a stepping up. People, all kinds of people stepping up, including wealthy people, giving toward organizations that are about defending the rights of immigrants, defending people from attack and deportation. I think there's a huge surging forward to stop bad things from happening, including, you know, more tax cuts for the wealthy, which is something that the current administration and Congress want. So I think I see a sort of awakening and a surge of activity. There are wealthy people who are trying to, you know, who are kind of bunkering down. In fact, there's a kind of interesting article in the New Yorker this week about, you know, wealthy people creating doomsday preparation, anticipating the collapse of civilization, and buying their bunkers or buying their island getaways and that sort of thing. My message to that group is like, that is delusional. You know, you're not going to find another planet, and you're not going to be able to buy your way out. Your money isn't going to solve the problem here. Your money could make a difference in supporting social institutions and efforts to build healthy communities. So it's, again, it's another place where the wealthy's real interests are to come home and be part of building healthy and resilient communities. And this idea that they're going to somehow opt out is delusional.
Well, Chuck, every time I talk to you, I have 1,000 more questions that come up that I want to ask you. You should see my list of notes on my pad of paper right here as we're recording this show. But we are, unfortunately, running down to the end of our time together. And I want to remind the listeners that Chuck Collins is a researcher and a scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies. He's written numerous books, including the most recent that we've been talking about, which is called Born on Third Base. And he also has been involved in forming many organizations that work on addressing the problems of inequality in our country. He, as you can notice, listeners, is quite well versed on not just the statistics of the issues, but the heart of it, what we're really dealing with as human beings as we circle around this issue historically and contemporarily and try to solve it. Chuck, I want to give you the last few minutes of the show to give a message to our listeners about anything that's on your mind that you think they should know about this subject or think about as they're going out from today's show, but also let them know where they can find your book, because I think they, like me, might enjoy reading it since it's written in such a conversational style with so many great points, but also great stories, true stories from your lifetime of experience of working on this issue.
Well, thank you for that. And thank you. And we time flies when you and I talk. I mean, the one thing is, I think on the one hand, it is a new era politically. We're sort of waking up every day to these amazing pronouncements. But I think it's important to go back a couple months and remember that a lot of what happened in this election has to do with these inequalities that we're talking about. That when you have a polarized economy you have a polarized politics. But when people feel unequal and feel like things are insecurity is growing, there's a populist response. And it could be like a progressive populist response, like a sort of Bernie Sanders. And that movement didn't vanish. It didn't go away. All those people are still here and understand how important addressing these inequalities are. But even the people who went the other way, what I would call regressive populists, are still responding to that sense that insecurity is growing, that the rules of the economy are rigged. They have been encouraged to deflect their anger onto people of color and new immigrants and liberal elites or whoever. But at the underlying core are these inequalities. So I think it's important to remember inequality is central to the moment we're living in. Donald Trump and his program is not going to address the deep root causes, the drivers of these inequalities, and they are going to continue to grow, as will the movement to realign the priorities and politics of this country. So I think we are heading into a realignment, a transition politically. It is a new era in that regard, but I don't necessarily assume it's going to be a right-wing pro-corporate phase forever. I think the pendulum will shift. But I welcome people. I think one of the easiest ways to stay connected to the work that I do is visit the website inequality.org, which I help co-edit. And we send out a Monday newsletter. It actually comes from me. So you can sign up at the website for that. And you'll get – we sort of have what we call the four H's. We try to let you know the horrors of these inequalities, the hope. We bring a certain amount of humor and heart to communicating about these issues. So that's a place to stay connected to this work and learn more about things we can do together. So inequality.org is a good home base going forward.
Well, Chuck, thank you so much for joining us today on Love and Revolution Radio.
Thanks, Rivera.
Thanks this week to our guest, Chuck Collins, for his insightful and very interesting conversation on inequality and wealth. Our theme song is Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson, performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find more of her great music at www.dianepatterson.org. Love and Revolution Radio is a weekly radio program. Your local radio station can broadcast it, so just ask them if they will. You can reach us via the Love and Revolution page on my website, www.riverasun.com, and we are Love and Revolution Radio on Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes. For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm your host, Rivera Sun. Chuck Collins has offered a bold invitation to the wealthy to bring their wealth home. But you know what? Woven into that invitation are ideas for all of us, no matter where we stand in the 100%. So listeners, perhaps you'll take another look at your own definition of true wealth and how we should be sharing our resources by the time we talk to you next week.